You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton.
The Finger Lakes group of the Sierra Club has scheduled the following outings for spring. On April 8th, an 8-mile hike of the Finger Lakes Trail near Hammond Hill. And also in April, the final date, to yet be determined, a canoe trip on the Chemung River. For more information on these outings, contact Carol Knight at cknight@ithaca.edu. That's the letter C, Knight, as in Knight in Shining Armor, at ithaca.edu, or phone area code 607-256-7682. 256-7682. Sandy Johnson is active in the community radio movement and also hosts a weekly radio show, Talking Stick, featuring issues of concern to goddess-centered religions. She spoke with Jerry Hildebrand of ARIN, the Alternative Religious Educational Network, about the nonprofit network's open letter being distributed in response to the G.W. Bush proposal to funnel tax dollars to faith-based groups. Who decides what is a legitimate religion, and on what basis, other than their personal prejudices?
ARIN, or ARIN, or the Alternative Religions Educational Network, as it's known in its many forms, started many, many years ago, about 29 years ago, with Dr. Leo Martello, who originally formed the Witches Anti-Defamation League. And from there, WADL has transformed into ARIN as a result of needing to change our name so that we wouldn't be confused with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of the United States. So we went through this transformation with our name, and that's where we are at this point.
Now, that transformation just recently happened within the last year.
Couple of years, yep.
There's a letter that particularly that we're going to be talking about that is posted on the front page of the ARIN site. When people go to visit that, that's what they're greeted with. And the letter basically outlines concerns that the organization, as well as other members of the greater alternative religions community, share about the current initiative that President Bush has put forth as far as the faith-based community programs, where government funding will be issued to non-secular groups as a result of this new initiative.
Uh-huh.
Now, what has made the group decide to publicly address this faith initiative with this letter?
Well, part of our charge is to address the issues of our community, whether it's, with the political systems, with the interfaith systems, but to look at the areas where the earth religious faith communities are oppressed in the languaging or in the speaking of who we are. And the biggest place where that shows up is around legal stuff and political issues. Parents lose custody of children, people lose jobs, all because of misunderstandings of terminology. Or, like what's happening with the faith-based initiative, we are taken not seriously because of, jokes that are made by congressmen, by media people, and things like that. And so part of our charge is to educate those branches of society.
Now, with the current background of ARIN going back to WADL and the years of service that it has been providing, I believe over a couple of decades now, why would ARIN or any other alternative faith-based group be opposed to this initiative? What are some of the specifics that you're outlining in that letter?
Well, some of the specifics are things like programs that may be instituted in communities by faith groups that may be the dominant faith groups in our society that don't necessarily address the needs of people in other faith groups or in smaller faith groups or alternative groups even. Say, for instance, there's an addiction program that's being serving a particular community in a small town in the Midwest by a Christian organization that tends to be pretty far to the right. For someone who may have an addiction problem from the earth-centered community to be forced into going to that program for one reason or another, or that may be the only program in their community, they stand with the possibility that that organization will not be sympathetic to their faith needs, be up in their faces with their own particular brand of religion, or not, or even outing them in a community if, say, they may be the only person in that community who's pagan.
So would it be correct to assume then that the government money that would supposedly be going to these faith-based groups is actually going to promote their particular religious agendas in the communities that they're serving?
Well, I think that's a strong possibility. I mean, especially if programs are happening within their church structures, within their buildings. I mean, it's only natural that, collateral material and advertising material for that particular faith community will be out there on display and stuff. The concern is that it will be more so, that it will be more up in people's faces, that it will be something that there's no choice about.
Right.
And I think that that's maybe the biggest thing here, is the bottom line is it's about choice.
Now, earlier we were talking about some of the public statements that have been made by members of the government, members of the media, and they have given you, as well as other people in the community, the impression that Wiccan and pagan-based faith groups are invalid, would be discriminated against, or wouldn't be looked at as a valid organization in order to compete on the level with the other faith-based groups.
Right.
Now, what type of statements have you noted, and can you mention what type of public officials you've heard these statements from?
Sure. There have been comments on mostly media-type shows that give the illusion that paganism is, and earth-centered religions are certainly not valid, that they are something to be laughed at and joked about, that they don't even make a difference and in people's lives. And so I think that what we're looking at is uncovering some of that. And like with the Bob Barr issue last year, Bob Barr was very public in speaking the fact that he didn't feel that Wiccans or witches had any place in the military, and really worked hard.
And that, of course, sprung from the Fort Hood incident, where it was kind of becoming more public that a circle of Wiccans were meeting on the military base.
Exactly.
And that somehow got blown into a huge ordeal and gave the pagan community reason to contact their respective congresspeople and explain to them the truths that were being misrepresented by other members of Congress.
Right. Well, even on McLaughlin's one-on-one, Stephen Goldsmith, of the domestic policy advisor to the president, spoke ill of Wicca during his interview on that show. And he said, and I quote, he said he did not think that Wiccans would meet the standard of being humane providers of domestic violence shelters. Now, in a faith group that honors the earth, that honors the people walking on it, that honors each and every creature, that's kind of diametrically opposed, a statement that's diametrically opposed to how earth religious faith groups believe.
Right.
And so it shows his lack of education around the issues.
Well,
and then on CNN, Bill Press and Tucker Carlson on the show Spin Room, Wicca was heavily debated. And they were very flip in their conversation about Wiccan hospitals and chicken sacrificing and how the government couldn't possibly give them funds because it's unlikely under President Bush that witches would get funding. And again, it's an ignorant statement. It shows that they know absolutely nothing about what earth religious groups even think or believe in.
Or at least are doing what they're supposed to be doing as far as corporate media goes,
right,
and spreading the mistruths and keeping
and
in that perspective. Yeah.
It also, it's like, and there are food pantries and prison ministries.
Absolutely.
And programs out there that have been very successfully put together by the Wiccan communities, by the Druidic communities, by lots of the Earth faith groups. And so, and they may be small programs by comparison to something, say, that the larger organizations are doing out there, but nonetheless, they're making a difference in those faith communities. So, you know, I would be led to ask, why wouldn't they be a candidate for the same kind of funding, making the same kind of difference that the larger programs are doing?
Right, and it's really kind of interesting to note, too, that the U.S. Army Handbook for Chaplains notes a section in there for Wiccan pagan practice and beliefs.
Absolutely.
Also, the Internal Revenue Service, which is another government program, also recognizes many different organizations as 501c3s that are pagan-oriented.
Sure.
So if we have the military, which is government-funded, we have the IRS, which is government-ran, acknowledging that Wiccan organizations and the Wiccan faith is valid in their eyes, I just don't understand how come the government just continues to deny validation to Wiccans in the public sector.
Right, and to take it a step further, who should be validating what religions are
exactly.
valid anyways? Under our Constitution, we have the freedom of religion. If I wanted to believe that the jackrabbit that sits outside of my house is, you know, a god of some sort, then under my Constitution, I should be able to believe that. Just like if I were to believe there were one primary deity there that did it all for me.
Right.
Either way, if I believe that, and that's where my faith and my religion revolves around, then under our Constitution, I should be protected. But that's not that. I think that the possibility lies in that if you start dictating what's valid faith when it comes to this program, you begin to start putting into place the erosion of the freedom of religion under our Constitution and under the Bill of Rights. And I also think that you also start eroding the whole separation of church and state.
And that's definitely been very apparent in the recent activities there on Capitol Hill.
Right, right.
Let's get back to the letter, because that's really what we're kind of focusing on at this point. We only have a few more weeks that this letter will be available for people to sign their name to as
yep.
well. Now, we noted that there was an original letter with the original signatories was supposed to be sent here at the end of February. Has that already been sent off?
That was sent at the end of February, and so this and then a secondary edition of the letter has gone out, and that edition of the letter had close to 1,200 signatures on it. And then the next round, the third letter, will go out after this weekend. And my guess at that point, we're going to have easily another 1,600 signatures. We're garnering approximately 600 signatures daily. Right now, we're almost over 2,000 signatures in less than 48 hours of having the website up.
That's really incredible, and it just shows the power of networking among pagans and the Earth-centered community online.
Right. I mean, the press release that went out in regards to the letter to bring people to the website really went out to, I would say, started with approximately six different email lists of national and regional pagan leadership, all activists, ministers, authors of books, things like that. And from there it has spread, and people sent them to their communities, and other people sent it to their communities. We ended up on salon.com, on their website, which leads back to our website for people to sign. It's gone out into the Unitarian Universalist Association's community through the Earth-centered faith people in that organization. So So it's really, it's showing the power of the web.
Right.
It's
And
really
the power,
incredible.
You can feel it is starting to spiral upwards. So
yes.
That's really wonderful. And commendations to everybody who worked on that letter. It's a beautiful piece of written material. And it really points out specifics that needs to be addressed upon this faith-based initiative going forward. And... You know, I know a lot of people in the faith-based community on the other side of the fence are really pushing hard, and they have a lot of resources behind them, compared to what the other side is facing, which is just mostly opposition.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Today, the Jewish several Jewish communities came out against the initiative also.
And that's interesting to note, that it's not just pagan and earth-centered communities, it's other
Pat
communities.
No, Pat Robertson himself is even concerned about it now, as are several other Christian organizations who realize that people are angry and they want separation of church and state. And if, and if that were the truth, if church and state were separate, or if this money must be delivered equally, it's not going to put... those who thought they could push an agenda through here in a very good position.
So what are your hopes in regards to the effect that this letter may have on this administration's decisions and future views of how minority religions will be viewed in the wake of all of this?
Well, President Bush, when he was inaugurated, said that he was the people's president, that he was there to represent us and to be there for us. And this is to keep him honed up to his word. He represents the United States of America. To be pushing a particular faith agenda through, or to be pushing agendas based on religion through, period, doesn't represent the people of America. It just doesn't. And so this is to hold him to his word, that he represents all of us as the leader of this country. And when you're representing everyone, having a particular position on issues like this is explosive in any point.
I definitely agree, and I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to talk to us, and we hope that the signatures just keep pouring in. It's March 14th, I believe, is the deadline that's been
March
set.
March 14th, we'll wrap everything up into the final letter, and that will be sent out on March 15th, which... interestingly enough, is the Ides of March.
Right.
And we will send it out. And after that, what we will do is put the letter in a petition form in a PDF file on the website for people to download and get signatures in their own areas and, actually handwritten signatures and be able to send them in on their own. And then that way we can kind of keep this going and keep the heat on. Gently. I'm not interested in, being totally up in people's faces. I want us to gently keep reminding and keep being a presence and a strong presence.
Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for all the efforts that you and Aaron and the rest of the pagan leadership that has been working on this has been doing. We definitely appreciate it, and I'm hoping that the people who are listening to this interview will take some time to, weigh their personal opinions and come up with a viewpoint that, will hopefully further us into more of a tolerant society as far as discriminating against minority religions and getting the word out that paganism isn't what the media is proposing it to be, and just to get to know some of the people who are behind some of the movements is really important in order to, progress forward with being able to be seen as a valid faith.
Yeah. So, well, thank you very much. And I actually want to thank the communities, the earth religious communities, in general, the people who have signed the letter. It really is an opportunity to come together in spite of even our variety of differences, and which it doesn't happen very often.
Right.
And to be able to have a place where we all can come and stand together and say, no, this isn't who we are, and this is who we are, is just incredibly powerful and really really shows who we are.
Well, thank you once again. We've been talking with Jerry Hildebrand. She is the director of the public relations for the Alternative Religions Educational Network.
That was Jerry Hildebrand of Aaron speaking with Sandy Johnson in Fresno, California. And this is the text of the letter being distributed by Aaron, dated February 19th, 2001. Dear President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and honored government officials, we are a coalition of concerned citizens of faith. We come from many different faith groups, including Wicca, neo-paganism, and earth religious traditions. We've watched the recent events in our country with great interest. These events will undoubtedly have profound effects on our communities in the future. Our first concern is with the Office of Faith-Based Action and Community Initiative. In this program, faith-based groups will be able to compete equally with non-religious organizations for funding. We question whether giving tax dollars to faith groups while withholding funds from secular organizations is in keeping with the separation of church and state our founding fathers prescribed. We fear that the funding given to contract-winning faith groups will be used to pay the yearly incomes of persons who may support and spread intolerance or violence based on religious, racial, or ethnic supremacist ideals. They would be able to discriminate in hiring and firing persons with views not in sympathy with their own. We are concerned that the government will appear to be supporting ideologies and theologies that are discriminatory and exclusionary. We are also concerned that some secular organizations will be forced to cease services due to lack of governmental funding. Such programs may be the only non-religious choice in small communities, and their termination could force some needy participants into a religious-based program with which they may be uncomfortable. Situations could also be created where persons who are in need of services face discrimination in the overall community. Our second major concern is with equality. While the public has been reassured that they will not be subject to discrimination and civil rights violations by this program, we have already witnessed incidents to the contrary. Wicca in particular has been subject to discriminatory comments made by members of our government and the media while promoting this particular program. It has been stated that Wiccan organizations will not be able to compete on a fair level with other organizations and will not acquire funding in the future. Some governmental figures have even defamed Wiccan adherents by suggesting that Wicca is somehow substandard in comparison to other faith traditions. These comments discriminate by their very nature. We are disturbed by the ease with which these governmental representatives are willing to promote inequality in our great nation. For many years now, Wiccans and earth-based faiths have qualified for state incorporation and IRS tax-exempt status. They have opened centers of worship across the country. They have been a part of the U.S. Army's handbook for chaplains and a guide for ministering in a pluralistic world. Indeed, Wicca is one of the fastest-growing religions in the United States. Our Constitution and the Bill of Rights grant freedom of religion to each citizen. As our representatives, you are oath-bound to uphold the rights of Americans granted in these documents. Freedom of religion means freedom of religion for all. Ladies and gentlemen, we ask you to unite Americans in freedom and equality. This country and its resources are for everyone, regardless of race, religion, sex, or age. We ask that our tax dollars be given to initiatives, programs, and organizations that do not discriminate. The signatures on this letter represent the many congregations and clergy in sympathy with us in the United States today. We represent all 50 states and territories. We represent men, women, and children of all walks of life. We represent business owners, property owners, and a variety of bipartisan voices. More importantly, however, We represent votes. Your decisions today will affect how we vote in the future. And that was the letter titled, An Open Statement to President George Bush, Members of Congress, and Various Other Government Officials from a Coalition of Minority Faith Leaders. As of March 6, 2001, there have been more than 3,000 signatures received and added to the letter. If you'd like to add your name to the Aaron Letter, you can visit their website at www.aaron.org. That's AREN.org. Alexis Buss is the General Secretary of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, a radical labor union that was targeted and almost obliterated by U.S. government attacks in the early 20th century. Over the past decade, the IWW and the idea of radical unionism, unionism geared toward ending the wage system, is making a comeback. Alexis spoke last fall at the New England Anarchist Book Fair.
When most of us think about labor actions and so on, we're usually thinking about the traditional strike because people haven't got a contract. There's some kind of contract dispute between a boss and a worker, so people go out on strike. And that's really the only time we hear about unions these days, and we certainly don't hear a lot about workers who aren't affiliated with unions doing direct actions. But of course, if you're a working person, you know that that kind of stuff happens all the time. Because this is an anarchist book fair, I want to start with a story about a rather well-timed strike, threat of a strike, going on in Philadelphia right now. That's where I'm from. The teachers' union is working without a contract at the moment. The state has passed laws, they're public employees, and the state passed laws to say that the city is not legally allowed to extend the terms of their previous contract into now when they have no contract. It's a typical thing that public employees get when they're in the middle of the negotiations. The terms of the contract are extended to prevent a strike because it's the old terms. It's not as bad as imposing unilateral new conditions on their labor. But that's exactly what the city's done. The city has decided to institute a merit pay system. If you're an academic or a teacher, you will know that merit pay, when it comes to especially when it comes to a learning environment, is very difficult. It means that there's all kinds of politics in the working relationship then, and so on. And they're also asking the teachers, well, they're forcing the teachers to work an hour extra every day for no increase in pay whatsoever. In Philadelphia, most of the elections, which are coming up, of course, very soon, about 80% of them are conducted in the schools. The voting booths aren't in the schools yet. If the teachers go on strike, Philadelphia won't be able to vote. And it's very interesting because now there's a lot of saber rattling about them going out on strike at this very interesting time. And it's very unusual, too, for a public employees union to buck politicians all together by saying, well, you're not going to have your rosary for this weekend, you know, this is the equivalent of what their elections are. So the reason why I'm telling you this is because when you do things like strikes and so on, timing is really everything. If you go out, you know, teachers never go on strike during the summer. Why would they? They can continue to draw pay. They're not working anyway. You always hear about strikes in the beginning of the school year. So this, I think, is very interesting. I think anarchists especially should keep their eye on it because it really would be a historic event if a group of teachers went out on strike and there were no elections, and Pennsylvania also being a swing vote state for Gore or Bush, it'll be especially interesting. I always start these by taking a quick poll of the audience. I'm curious to know who's been in a business union before, who's been represented by a union in their workplace before. Okay, less than 10%. We're less than the usual population. And then, of course, who's had a job before, right? Okay, you probably have the same experience as most of the rest of us. The direct action that we usually feel when we're working on a job usually amounts to giving the boss a hard time in some way that's not related to a labor management contract at all. And that's what the Wobblies like, but we like it when it's done in an organized way. Organized by a bureaucracy, of course, but organized from the shop floor. And something I'd like to address, is the meaning of direct action when we talk about it. Because you see the words around a lot lately, especially with the Seattle style of demonstrations now, the variety that everyone's trying to shut down the city or shut down a meeting. And I think a lot of that's kind of wrongfully been described as direct action. And the reason why I say that is because direct action, as it's been classically defined, is when the action that you're taking is directly addressing the grievance that you have. Okay? You might put it opposed to, say, petition action, when the action that you're taking is trying to petition another party to address your grievance for you. So, for instance, blocking the streets in Seattle wouldn't really affect, you know, global capitalism much. You're more petitioning the WTO to change it, or maybe you're just angry at the WTO for them existing or so on. Direct action, as it's classically defined, is not really protest action, protest-type stuff as we normally see it these days, but it rather addresses directly the grievance that you're having. So an example of that, for instance, would be if you're working in an unsafe machine or something, direct action answer would be to shut down the machine or sabotage the machine so it can't be used at all or do things like that. A petition action would be to stop using the machine, go out of your workplace and have a protest and some kind of publicity campaign around it. Certainly there's different times that both are appropriate, but I think it's an important distinction to make because once we lose the meaning of certain concepts, then we would hate to not avail ourselves of those concepts just because we confuse one kind with the other kind. It's good to be critical of our different strategies. I always like to have story time, and I'll start with one, but then hopefully other people will share stories about what they've done at their workplaces to do quick actions that are on the job that don't involve losing pay, but do articulate a specific demand of the boss. Here's an example. I was working on a campaign in a restaurant in Louisiana, and the workers there were upset because the boss was fighting their union drive by firing people and then giving some organizers worse shifts than others. And in a restaurant, there's all kinds of little regulations. One of them is all employees must wash hands before leaving the restroom. So the workers decided that they would become absolute neat freaks and hypochondriacs, and all of them went into the bathroom and just washed their hands for, you know, 10, 15 minutes. And then soon there was no soap and they couldn't wash their hands. So you had, like, you know, 15 workers in the bathroom because they couldn't leave the restroom because they couldn't wash their hands. You know, the boss couldn't really say, you know, like, get out of there, don't wash your hands. You know, that would be illegal and it would be horrible. Plus there was a restaurant full of people. So I thought it was well timed. They timed it for right before the lunch hour. So they weren't missing their tips, but, you know, pretty soon the restaurant would have been in big trouble. The boss ended up conceding to not having what we call captive meetings, which is the boss makes everybody come into a meeting. Everybody has to come to a meeting and listen to anti-union propaganda. So the boss cut that, get anybody rehired, but it was not the most militant action, but it was kind of fun. Being a working person, it has never impressed me, for instance, like the Marxist idea that once things get bad enough, then people will become revolutionaries and overthrow the system. I don't think I buy it anymore. And I think things are bad enough to justify overthrowing the system. I think that's a challenge for radical unionists, of course. I was involved in an organizing drive where we signed a contract, and the workers didn't want a miniature class war every day. But how do you continue to educate them on the need to overthrow capitalism? The value of revolutionary unions is that they at least pose the question. Business unions don't. They're perfectly happy to keep people wage slaves for the rest of their lives, and it's just totally out of the orbit of their thoughts to think, what about a world without bosses, which is, of course, the point of the IWW. It's a chance to radicalize people by showing that there are practical results to organizing and that their organizations are democratic and are able to have a revolutionary perspective on things happening in society, things happening in their workplace, and so on. Because really, the fundamental answer to so many of the problems in workplaces is that capitalism should be abolished. We see organizing as a way to articulate that. Just because you have an IWW organizing drive, and certainly, you know, it's never going to happen if you're in an AFL union, people aren't going to, like, take up arms and throw the boss out on the street and take over the factory and so on. That's some bizarre fantasy. I think it's a way to radicalize people who aren't radicals and to pose questions that probably wouldn't get posed any other way. I'm all for ameliorating bad conditions because I live in them and I don't like them. I I think that what we can't say is that union organizing is the only way to bring about the education level needed to have people start thinking about ways that we should put society, you know, back in order. By the way that we work now, that society works, it's going to have to be all kinds of different types of organizing. If we don't have the practice to run workplaces or to have democratic organizations or so on, the U.S. in particular is much more likely to have a fascist revolution than it is to have any kind of anarchist revolution, just because the working class isn't organized. And it would be much easier for people, when they become upset that the stock market crashed and that we're in another depression and so on, unless we have the practice to make organizations, then we're screwed.
That was Alexis Buss, General Secretary of the Industrial Workers of the World, a radical trade union. Cindy Milstein teaches at the Institute for Social Ecology in Plainfield, Vermont. Her work focuses on how direct democracy can be implemented on a local level to return decision-making to people's hands. Today we're going to hear a presentation of her essay, Reclaim the Cities from Protest to Popular Power, which she gave at the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference in Plainfield, Vermont, last year.
Direct action gets the goods, proclaimed the industrial workers of the world nearly a century ago. And in the short time since Seattle, this has certainly proven to be the case. Indeed, the goods, reaped by the new direct action movement here in North America, have included creating doubt as to the scope and nature of globalization, shedding light on the nearly unknown workings of international trade and finance bodies, and making anarchism and anti-capitalism nearly household words. And as if that weren't enough, we find ourselves on the streets of 21st century metropolises, demonstrating our power to resist in a way that models the good society we envision, a truly democratic one. But is this really what democracy looks like? The impulse to, quote, reclaim the streets is an understandable one. When industrial capitalism first started to emerge in the early 19th century, its machinations were relatively visible. Take, for instance, the enclosures, pasture lands that had been used in common for centuries to provide villages with their very sustenance were systematically fenced off, or enclosed, in order to graze sheep, whose wool was needed for the burgeoning textile industry. Communal life was briskly thrust aside in favor of privatization, forcing people into harsh factories and crowded cities. Advanced capitalism, as it pushes past the fetters of even nation-states in its insatiable quest for growth, encloses life in a much more expansive, yet generally invisible way. Fences are replaced by consumer culture. We are raised in an almost totally commodified world where nothing comes for free, even futile attempts to remove oneself from the market economy. This commodification seeps into not only what we eat, wear, or do for fun, but also into our language, into our relationships, and even our very biology and minds. We've lost not only our communities and public spaces, but control over our very lives. We've lost the ability to define ourselves outside of capitalism's grip, and thus genuine meaning itself begins to dissolve. Whose streets are streets, then, is a legitimate emotional response to the feeling that even the most minimal of public, non-commodified spheres has been taken away from us. Yet in the end, it is simply a frantic cry from our cage. We have become so confined, so thoroughly damaged by capitalism as well as state control, that crumbs appear to make a nourishing meal. Temporarily closing off the streets during direct actions does provide momentary spaces in which to practice democratic process, and it even offers a sense of empowerment. But such events leave power for power's sake, like the very pavement beneath our feet, unchanged. It's only when the serial protest mode is escalated into a struggle for popular or horizontal power that we can create cracks in the figurative concrete, thereby opening up ways to challenge capitalism, nation-states, and other systems and forms of domination. This is not to denigrate the direct action movement in the U.S. and elsewhere, just the opposite. Besides a long overdue and necessary critique of numerous institutions of command and obedience, the movement is quietly yet crucially supplying the outlines of a freer society. This prefigurative politics is, in fact, the very strength and vision of today's direct action, where the means themselves are also understood to be the ends. We're not putting off the good society until some distant future or until some after some revolution, but attempting to carve out room for it in the here and now, however tentative and contorted under the given social order. In turn, this consistency of means and ends implies an ethical approach to politics. How we act now is how we want others to begin to act as well. We try to model a notion of goodness even as we fight for goodness. This can implicitly be seen in the affinity group and spokes council structures for decision-making at direct actions. Both supply much-needed spaces in which to school ourselves in direct democracy. Here, in the best of cases, we can proactively set the agenda, carefully deliberate together over questions, and come to decisions that strive to take everyone's needs and desires into account. Substantive discussion replaces checking boxes on a ballot. Face-to-face participation replaces handing over our lives to so-called representatives. Nuanced and reasoned solutions replace lesser of two or three evil thinking. The democratic process utilized during demonstrations decentralizes power even as it offers tangible solidarity. For example, affinity groups afford greater and more diverse numbers of people a real share in decision-making, while spokes councils allow for intricate coordination, even on a global level. This is, as 1960s activists put it, the power to create rather than destroy. The beauty of this new movement, it could be said, is that it strives to take its own ideals to heart. In doing so, it has perhaps unwittingly created the demand for such directly democratic practices on a permanent basis. Yet the haunting question underlying episodic, quote, street democracy remains unaddressed. How can everyone come together to make decisions that affect society as a whole in participatory, mutualistic, and ethical ways? In other words, how can each and every one of us, not just a counterculture, not just a protest movement, really transform and ultimately control our lives and that of our communities on a day-to-day regular basis? This is, in essence, a question of power. Who has it, how it is used, and to what ends it is used? To varying degrees, we all know the answer in relation to current institutions and systems. We can generally explain what we are against. That is exactly why we're protesting, whether it's against capitalism, nation-states, or globalization in whole or part. But what this movement has largely failed to articulate is any sort of response in relation to liberatory institutions and systems. We often can't express, particularly in any coherent and utopian manner, exactly what we are for. Even as we prefigure a way of making power horizontal, equitable, and hence hopefully an essential part of what would be a free society, we ignore the reconstructive vision that a directly democratic process holds up right in front of our noses. For all intents and purposes, then, our movement remains trapped. On the one hand, it reveals and confronts domination and exploitation. The political pressure exerted by such widespread agitation may even be able to influence current power structures to amend some of the worst excesses of their ways. The powers that be have to listen and respond to some degree when the voices become too loud and too numerous. Nevertheless, people are still ultimately shut out of the decision-making process itself, and consequently, we ultimately have little tangible power over our lives. Without this ability to self-govern, street actions translate into nothing more than a counter-cultural version of special interest group lobbying, be it far more radical than most and generally unpaid. What the movement forgets is the promise implicit in its own structure, that power not only needs to be contested, it must also be constituted anew in liberatory and egalitarian forms. This entails taking the movement's directly democratic process seriously, not simply as a tactic to organize the protests, but as the very way we would ultimately organize society itself, specifically the political realm. The issue then becomes, how do we begin to shift the strategy, structure, and values of our movement to the most grassroots level of public policymaking? The most fundamental level of decision-making in a demonstration, as most of us know who have been to them, is the affinity group. Here we come together as friends or because we share some kind of a common identity or some combination of the two. We share something in particular. Indeed, this common identity is often reflected in the name we choose for our affinity groups. We may not always agree with each other, but there's a fair amount of homogeneity precisely because we've consciously chosen together, come together for a very specific reason, most often having little to do with mere geography. This sense of a shared identity allows for the smooth functioning of a consensus decision-making process, since we start from a place of commonality. In the affinity group, almost by definition, our unity needs to take precedence over our diversity, or otherwise the supposed affinity, the reason we've come together, breaks down altogether. Compare this to what could be the most fundamental level of decision-making in a society, a neighborhood or a town. Now, geography plays a much larger role. Because of historic, economic, religious, cultural, and a host of other reasons, we may find ourselves living side by side with a wide range of individuals and their various identities. Most of these people are not our friends, per se. Still, the very diversity we encounter is a life of what makes a vibrant city itself. The accidents or numerous personal decisions that have brought us together often create a fair amount of heterogeneity, precisely because we have not all chosen to come together for any particular reason. In this context, where we start from a place of difference, decision-making mechanisms need to be much more capable of allowing for dissent. That is, diversity now needs to be clearly retained within any notions of unity. As such, I would argue, majoritarian decision-making processes now make more sense. Then, too, there's the question of scale. It's hard to imagine being friends with hundreds or even thousands of people, nor maintaining a single-issue identity with that many individuals. But we can share a feeling of community and a striving towards some common good that allows each of us to flourish. In turn, when greater numbers of people come together on a face-to-face basis to reshape their neighborhoods and towns, the issues as well as the viewpoints will hopefully multiply, and alliances will no doubt change depending on the specific topic under discussion. Thus, the need for a place where we can meet now as human beings at the most face-to-face level, that is, at an assembly of active citizens, to share our many identities and interests in hopes of balancing both the individual and the community in all we do. As well, trust and accountability function differently at the affinity group versus the civic level. We generally reveal more of ourselves to friends, and such unwritten bonds of love and affection hold us more closely together, or at least, I would hope, they give us added impetus to work things out. Underlying this is a higher-than-average degree of trust, which serves to make us accountable to each other. Once we reach a community-wide level, the reverse is more often true. Accountability is what allows us to trust each other. Hopefully, we share bonds of solidarity and respect. Yet since we can't all know each other well, such bonds only make sense if we first determine them together, then record them or write them down, and have something to refer back to in the future, and even revisit or re-decide upon them if needed. Accountable democratic structures of our own making, in short, provide the foundation for trust, since the power to decide is both transparent and ever amenable to scrutiny. There are also issues of time and space. Affinity groups, in the scheme of things, are generally temporary configurations. They may only last a few months or a few years, but often not much longer. Once the particular reasons why we've come together have less of an immediate imperative, or as our friendships falter, such groups often fall by the wayside. And even during a group's lifespan, in the interim between direct actions, there's frequently no place or even face to decision-making. There's no regularity, nor is there any record of who decided what and how. Moreover, affinity groups are not open to everyone, but only those who share a particular identity or attachment. And as such, although affinity groups can certainly choose to shut down a street, there's ultimately something slightly authoritarian in small groups taking matters into their own hands, no matter what their political persuasion is. Deciding what to do with the streets in general say how to organize transportation, encourage street life, provide green space, and so on, should be a matter open to everyone interested if it is to be truly participatory and non-hierarchical. This implies ongoing and open institutions of direct democracy for everything from decision-making to conflict resolution. We need to be able to know when and where citizen assemblies are meeting. We need to meet regularly and make use of non-arbitrary procedures. We need to keep track of what decisions have been made. But most important, if we so choose, we all need to have access to the power to discuss, deliberate, and make decisions about matters that affect our community and beyond. Indeed, many decisions have a wider impact than on just one city or neighborhood. Transforming streets, for example, would probably entail coordination on a regional, continental, or even global level. Radicals have long understood such mutualistic self-reliance as a, quote, commune of communes, unquote, or confederation. The spokes council model used during direct actions hints at such an alternative view of globalization. During a spokes council meeting, mandated delegates from our affinity groups gather together for the purpose of coordination, the sharing of resources or skills, the building of solidarity, and so forth, always returning to the grassroots level or the affinity group as the ultimate arbiter. If popular assemblies were our basic unit of decision-making, confederations of communities could serve as a way to both transcend parochialism and create interdependence where desirable. For instance, rather than global capitalism and international regulatory bodies, where trade is obviously top-down and profit-oriented, confederations could coordinate distribution between regions in ecological and humane ways, while allowing policy decisions in regard to production, say, to remain at the grassroots or town-neighborhood level. This more expansive understanding of a prefigurative politics would necessarily involve creating institutions that could potentially replace capitalism and nation-states. Such directly democratic institutions are compatible with, and could certainly grow out of, the ones we use at demonstrations, but they very likely won't be mirror images once we reach the level of society as a whole. This does not mean abandoning the principles and ideals undergirding our movement, freedom, cooperation, decentralism, solidarity, etc. It merely means recognizing the limits of direct democracy as it's practiced in the context of a demonstration. Any vision of a free society, if it is to be truly democratic, must of course be worked out by all of us, first in this movement and later in our communities and confederations. Even so, we will probably discover that newly defined understandings of citizenships are needed in place of affinity groups. The majoritarian methods of decision-making that strive to retain diversity are preferable to simple consensus-seeking models. That written compacts articulating rights and duties are crucial to fill out the unspoken culture of protests. And that institutionalized spaces for policymaking are key to guaranteeing that our freedom to make decisions doesn't disappear with a line of riot cops. It is time to push beyond the oppositional character of our movement by infusing it with a reconstructive vision. That means beginning right now to translate the movement structure into institutions that embody the good society. In short, cultivating direct democracy in the places that we call home. This will involve the harder work of reinvigorating or initiating civic gatherings, town meetings, neighborhood assemblies, citizen mediation boards, any and all forums where we can all come together to decide our lives, even if only in extra-legal institutions at first. Then, too, it will mean reclaiming globalization, not as a new phase of capitalism, but as its replacement by confederated, directly democratic communities coordinated for mutual benefit. It's time to move from protest to politics, from shutting down streets to opening up public space, from demanding scraps from those few in power to holding power firmly in all our hands. Ultimately, this means moving beyond the question of whose streets. We should ask instead, whose cities? Then and only then will we be able to remake the cities as our own.
That was Cindy Milstein from the Institute for Social Ecology in Plainfield, Vermont. More lectures from the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition are available through links on the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
For my guns and my